It is Saturday, February 24th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, spam and dynamic HTML. I'll explain how those connect, and of course, your questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
Northern California Public Broadcasting invites you to a town hall meeting about the future of the public TV in Monterey Bay area on Tuesday evening, March 6th at 6 p.m. at the National Steinbeck Center in Salinas. Information is available at 866-870-2528 or kteh.org/townhall.
Our guest on Geek Speak today is Danny Goodman. We'll be speaking with him in about 10 minutes. Danny Goodman is the author of Dynamic HTML, The Definitive Reference. We'll talk a little bit about Ajax Web 2.0 and Dynamic HTML. But, you know, of course, that's so dry and technical and geeky. We're also going to talk about his other book, Spam Wars. He knows a lot about the spam economy, as he calls it. And we'll talk with him in just a few minutes about that, how you can make yourself a little safer and better and understand what's going on. GeekSpeak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join the conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. Here are the numbers, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out those phone numbers again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam, Slacker, geek, and student. Miles?
Good morning.
And Sean Cleveland. Sean Cleveland is the technical marketing manager at NVIDIA.
Good morning, Lyle.
You know, Miles, if you gave me a good title to say, I would change my little script thing.
No, that was perfectly acceptable.
Slacker, geek, and student.
I have no problem with being called Slacker.
All right, good. Well, Slacker, you're up first on the news.
He hasn't even shaved. He looks like a slacker.
Yeah, I haven't shaved. Neither.
We're not about to say that everyone in the air room has a beard. A company called Polymer Vision has made a device known as the Redius, and it has a rollable display. What I mean by a rollable display is that it uses a technology known as e-ink, which is electronic ink, that the display looks very much like paper. In fact, people who have seen the device firsthand have said this looks exactly like a page of paper. It's not going to be made for full motion screens. It's not going to be used for gaming anytime soon. It takes about a half second for the screen to refresh. However, what's interesting about this device is the fact that it does, in fact, roll up. It's a flexible membrane. So you end up with something that's smaller than the palm of your hand that you can unfold to be the size of a standard paperback novel.
Is it metal? It looks like it's in a shell.
Is the display metal?
Is it housed in a frame that's collapsible? Or can you actually roll the display up?
You actually roll the display up. It's not a circular thing, but it is going around a
it's kind of like a scroll, yeah. Like you're kind of wrapping a piece of paper around
the device. Exactly.
Okay. And this thing, I'm assuming, doesn't have a backlit. It's like traditional paper where you have to have a light.
No, it does actually have a backlight for nighttime reading, but it looks best if you have it just in standard light. And it's always best to read when you have good lighting.
Okay.
Anyway.
Is this the book killer?
It's not big enough, in my opinion, yet. I mean, it's paperback size, so it's nice. It'll have a lot of good uses for it. I personally would like to see the one that's 8.5 inch by 11 and basically the exact same size as a sheet of paper, or maybe, you know, a centimeter margins.
Well, but a paper bezel. Book, reading a paper book's a good size to read. It holds in your hand everything. I mean, I personally like a hardbound, but for a book replacement, is this the kind of thing that we're talking about? Or do you see this as just a novelty that has a future?
I think it's the next step.
Okay.
Things are always going to get better. And I think it would be nice if you had a choice. They got so cheap that you could have one of each,
yeah.
You know, one that was a paperback size and one that was a larger size. Because I tend to read a lot of my stuff in PDF format, a lot of the PDFs are made with 8.5-inch by 11 in mind. So that's why I would prefer.
So the general idea, is this a black and white screen?
It's
okay, so this is basically a piece, a thin display that can be kind of, can roll up kind of small, and you open it up, and it takes about a half second for the entire thing to be drawn, but a computer draws
way
the data.
No.
It's a half second for an update. The actual display looks immediate, but when you say go to the next page, it takes a half second before the next one comes up.
So basically, it's good for reading long material, much better than maybe
And another aspect to e-ink is that it does not require power to keep the display showing the information. It's only when you change pages.
Right.
And
but it's not it's not backlit.
Well,
oh,
this
it
is. This one is.
Right? You need a light shining down on the surface.
No, this one is backlit.
No, this one I believe is backlit.
That's Are you sure about that? Most e-ink
I think it's a little strange to have a backlight.
Devices,
you just add a light to
are not backlit.
Well, I can double check. I may be totally wrong about
that. Okay, in any case, thank you for keeping us abreast of e-ink. Hi, Sean.
Hi. How about recyclable paper?
Okay, since we're talking about paper and displays, what about recycling paper?
Well, Xerox is developing a new printing technology that doesn't require ink of any kind.
Oh, how does it work?
So it uses reusable paper.
It's like the Emperor's New Clothes. Isn't this printout amazing? It's white. No, it's beautiful.
Only intelligent people can see it.
Well, you are a theater baby. You are a theater baby for sure. Okay, this paper is... it can be erased and printed on dozens of times. At least right now.
Okay.
So it uses special ultraviolet UV light source to write on this paper. And apparently the paper is black, and the UV gets rid of the black and leaves the printed.
So it's kind of like e-paper, except that you have to inject it.
You actually have to have a printer, yeah.
Okay, does that mean there's no ink cartridge in the printer?
No ink. No ink of any kind. Just
like
UV
that.
Light.
I'm telling you, the worst fraud right now is the cost on ink cartridges.
Can you imagine just having a printer, you print something? Even better, the pages degrade over time. So they actually start turning back, to black.
Nice. So if you don't read it soon, it
kind of puts
away.
A new spin on this message will self-destruct.
It's great. As long as you don't apply ultraviolet light, you're okay. But so you have a piece of paper and it's the ticket to the rave. And once you go inside, it's black. It's perfect.
Oh, yeah.
So
so right now you can write and rewrite to a sheet about 50 times.
Uh-huh.
And they're working on new processes.
How much does the sheet cost? $900.
It is only in the Xerox labs right now. So
that's cool. Thanks for that update.
Yeah, really cool.
On display technology. Miles, do you want to break the mold and go with something other than display technology, or do you just want to
hear
this again?
Yes, I absolutely do. There was some hubbub done about 2002 regarding a possible vehicle for cold fusion. And the scientist that was in charge of it...
When you say vehicle for cold fusion, you mean a vehicle that would use cold fusion?
No. A vehicle meaning a means to get cold fusion.
Okay,
in other words, getting...
That sounds better.
getting fusion from tabletop materials and something that would not require huge amounts of heat and plasma, plasma, which is normal fusion. Or hot fusion. And it was met with a great deal of skepticism using what's known as bubble fusion. Basically when a bubble...
Ultrasonic sounds hitting bubbles.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, it turns out another scientist has gone through and duplicated the effects that the first researcher had tried. So it looks like the effect may in fact be real.
Okay. Does this mean that we're going to be able to... solve our energy problems, or is it just another step in confirming that theory works?
It's just another step in confirming that theory works. We're not going to need large-scale power from this. We may not ever, but it's definitely showing us a bit more about the physical world, and that's great. And it's also good to see someone who, a scientist who's put up an experiment and getting panned for it, having someone else come back and having that peer review process really come to the fore.
The general concept of it is fusion, of course, is taking two atoms and merging them together to make a new atom. And the wonderful thing about the sun does that, I think, right?
Yes.
And the idea that's great about that is that your waste product is normally a stable compound. But the problem is it takes extremely high energies to do this. So the idea of the ultrasonic solution of these bubbles is you make a small bubble and then you collapse it quickly. And the collapsing force at a microscopic or nanoscale level is high energy enough to create new...
by using a frequency of sound to resonate.
Seems like a really cool way to do it. Of course, it takes a lot of energy to make the effect occur, but as long as you can make the effect occur, theoretically you can make a system which the energy came out of the effect itself. We'll see.
Yeah, you want to get, the idea is you want to get more energy out of the effect than you put into it, and that's how you generate electricity.
Great.
Or energy. Sean, you want to do one more news story before we go on to our guest? Because Danny's online, ready to go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's...
Well, yeah, I want to do another news story. So Georgia Tech researchers have developed a prototype engine, rocket engine, that that uses sort of a gear architecture. The idea is that currently when a rocket sends a payload into space, it's just a first gear type, you know, device, maximum, you know, thrust, throw as much, you know, fuel as necessary to get this thing into orbit. Well, of course, with new technologies, they're in vehicles, they're kind of putting this towards how can we cut down the energy, the requirements required with fuel to get these payloads into space,
okay,
without throwing so much into the atmosphere,
sure,
and using far less. So they think they can save up to 40%, and then basically these gears maximize acceleration during orbit transfers as well by using solar power. So not bad if they can do this.
Okay, so
they're talking more like four or five gears, and the rocket will at some point automatically detect just how much it needs acceleration, mm-hmm, it needs at any point during takeoff.
Okay, so
you get
multiple stages, and then you're carrying less at the higher altitudes. You have smaller fuel drops.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
Saving 40% energy.
Yeah, that could be pretty severe. Yeah. Of course, that's a whole bunch of more stages to deal with for technically and all of that. But, yeah, I like the idea.
I don't know if it's so much stages. It's actually just a more sophisticated engine.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Sean. Miles.
And one more.
Yes.
Just want to throw it out there. Robert Adler, a physicist and inventor of the television remote control.
Yes.
He died on February 15th in Boise, Idaho. He was 93.
All right. Well,
I use one every
day. Adding to the obesity of America since how long?
The remote control?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Miles. Unbelievable.
Geeks, thank you so much for doing news with me. We're now inviting the author, Danny Goodman, on to Geek Speak. Danny, welcome to our show.
Thanks very much.
Danny Goodman is someone I've been familiar with for years. I've been using his Dynamic HTML book. In fact, his DHTML book got me the job, which I met Miles at. So, Danny, if it weren't for your book and how legible it was and how it taught me to do DOM scripting, I never would have met Miles, and I would have given up on GeekSpeak a long time ago without his friendship. So thank you for...
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. Ask the audience in a few minutes. So, Danny, the other book that you have out, because, of course, the Dynamic HTML book is all about scripting on web pages. And I got to say that if you're looking to do any kind of scripting on websites, this is the book to get. It's this thick, 1,000 pages?
Take
a look. Yeah, it's huge. 1,256 pages, something like that. Huge reference book. Your most recent third edition updates for Ajax and Web 2.0. We'll do a little HTML discussion. What is it that has been added in this most recent revision?
Well, this one, the previous edition ended right before all this hubbub with Ajax, what has become known now as Ajax, and some newer scripting technologies that are now gradually finding their way into either standards or default standards, became embedded in the browsers. And now the things like, this is going to send everybody running for the off switch, I hope not, but there's an object that you can script that is called the XML HTTP request object, which is what's responsible for a lot of the easy interactivity and quick response to user interaction.
Like in Google and Gmail,
so much happens so quickly, because they're just refreshing part of the screen with information that is retrieved from the server. Same thing with Google Maps, not that I'm picking on Google, but that the fact that you can, drag the map around and it magically knows to fill in where you're going and
sure.
all that.
This is all done with an object called the XML HTTP request object.
Right.
The thing is, your last book had this object in it. Miles and I were using it for the job when we met each other. How long did we know each other, Miles? 6-7 years?
Far too long.
Yeah, but at that time it was really just part of the Internet Explorer browser. It was a proprietary object. And now the W3C DOM did have a facility for doing it in browsers like Mozilla-based browsers like early Firefox and
sure.
so on. But since then, that object has become... This is a case where a proprietary technology that Microsoft had first supported in Internet Explorer became a de facto standard in the other browsers. In fact, now it's a is a standard track that of its own within the W3C strictly for that object.
The XML request object.
Right.
This is basically the ability for your scripting engine to go talk to the web server without reloading the page.
Right.
It's a major benefit to making a page feel real snappy.
Yeah, because it can go, you know, instead of having to download everything possible into the page initially and then let the script maneuver it, it can just, it can go and make a quick query to a database, say, and just get some fresh numbers to fill in part of a table, and it can update just that part of the table.
Okay. Since we've talked so much about your one book that I know you for, let's talk about your next, your most recent endeavor, and that is Spam War. Your most recent book is actually called Spam Wars, I believe?
Well, it's not so much my most recent. The third edition of the DHTML reference is the most recent.
All right.
Spam Wars has been out for a couple of years, but it's the one that it covers a field that a lot of people are very...
We all hate spam.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're trying to say.
Yeah. And I've been battling it for well over 10 years just on my own inbox.
Mm-hmm.
And... I did a long research into not just what spam is about, but also what the spammers are doing, some of the more criminal elements of the of those who are attacking our computers and our identities and so on are after, and also what the spam fighting world is doing, not just in technology but also on the legal aspect.
Danny, what is it? Why is spam so? Why are we getting so much spam? Why is it working? What's the economy about?
Well, that's one of the things that few people seem to understand, and that they think, well, if you just don't buy from spammers, then everything will go away. However, there's far more to what I call the spam economy than just buying stuff from spammers, because the spammers themselves do things like use email addresses that they capture in a variety of ways, and we can talk about that stuff. As an asset that they sell to other spammers or trade to them. Our computers that get taken over by these what are called botnets, the use of that computer is sold to other spammers and virus spreaders and so on. Now, we're not getting a commission for that. But all that stuff is going on, and so that it as long as money is flowing to those who want to, take whatever they can get from wherever, that's going to keep the spamming and the virus stuff going.
Okay, well, is there a way to reduce the money that's going that direction? One thing, of course, is to never click on your emails, but you're saying it's more than just that.
Well,
how do you deal with it?
At this point, messaging is probably the primary vector of trying to get to stuff that's valuable that we own. Here are the things that we own that people, that these guys want. There's money that's in our pockets for products and so on.
Wait, they want our money?
Well, sure. Imagine that. Then they want our personal information for identity that they, again, can sell and, convert into dollars for themselves. They want our email addresses because those can be sold.
What's an email address worth?
A single email address is not worth a lot, but if your computer, for instance, gets infected with through a Trojan, gets a program in there that will literally scrape your hard disk for everything that looks like an email address, not just in your address book, but in pages that are cached in your web browser that have email addresses embedded in them. Documents of any kind.
Your address book?
Certainly your address book.
Sure.
That's the main target. But, if you look at some of the analyses of some of these worms, like at the Symantec and Sophos and some of those, when you see what these things do and how they rifle through your system, and, they'll have a list of, 20, 30 different file extensions that these things go through to look for documents with those file names with the extensions, and they will try to scrape as many email addresses as possible.
What do they do? Now, once this bot's on your machine and it's doing this kind of thing, and it gets these emails, what does it then do? Go and post it somewhere?
Well, it sends it back to wherever it phones home.
Yeah, the controller.
Right. Because a new, fresh email address is a valuable asset because it's someone, who... maybe haven't gotten all this stuff before.
There are no people that haven't gotten spam before, unless they
you'd be surprised.
Okay, so
but the point is that even if you don't use email a lot, and even so if you've just communicated, let's say you've communicated with your grandmother once or twice, and that's
that's it, right?
And her computer gets taken over. Then your address will go out there, and it's hosed. Once it's out there, you cannot reel it back in.
Okay. So basically what you're saying is the more you use your email, the more likely it's going to be on a computer that gets infected with one of these things, and
right.
then your email address is owned by spammers.
Right.
Okay. But they have to be making money other than just selling it between amongst themselves. They're getting money from some other company that's receiving funds from somebody, right?
Well, sure. There are a lot of ways that...
Products.
But not just that. I mean, you can be an email marketing firm, most of whom drive me up the wall because of the lies that they promulgate to their customers. And you might get paid, for the click-throughs to the spam-vertised website.
Uh-huh.
So just visiting the website, clicking on the link in an email message to a spam-vertised website might be putting money in the spammer's pocket.
So somebody's come up with a neat new invention, and they put up a website, and they're like, I really want to market this. So they go find some company. They say, hey, will you start marketing this for us? And they give them some money, and then the company's like, yeah, every click that you get to your website from us, you have to pay a certain amount of money.
Right.
And then they go and spam a whole bunch of people.
Right.
So what's the best way to fight this?
Well,
how do you make it better, Danny?
The best thing to do, and it's the hardest thing to do, is we have to do less with spam.
What?
Yeah, I know. When the quickest way to annoy somebody is to completely ignore them. And if let's just say in this blue sky.
Yeah, world, magic world.
World.
Yeah.
If there were no responses at all to spam, if we didn't click on links, if we didn't open messages that had images in them and retrieve those images,
mm-hmm.
if you don't open a spam message and you can't click on the link, you can't buy the pills or whatever, eventually, and it would take some time, but eventually the spam would go away because the word would get around that it is no longer a viable money making avenue.
One would hope. So how successful has that been? Your book has been out for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Is that message getting around? Is it working? Are people stopping the spam?
Well, the problem is that most of those who need to hear about this message don't hear about it. In fact, I would imagine that most people listening to this program are already, spammed up to their wazoo, and they have either, various filtering technologies installed or whatever. And so they're already doing something to minimize their exposure to the spams and viruses and
sure.
so on, which
mm-hmm.
is excellent. But it's those who don't, and those are the ones who respond to the Nigerian scams. Someone will say, well, how could someone in this day and age respond to that?
Yeah.
Well, they do. And there are people out there who are, sending thousands and thousands of dollars to these guys in the hopes of, making some million that doesn't exist. They're responding to the lottery scams. All of this stuff goes on because it works just enough. The cost of sending that stuff out is in favor of the sender because the incremental cost of sending millions of this stuff is negligible. The recipients end up paying more of the price. Our ISPs have to spend a ton of dough.
Sure.
Fight off the spam, and so
okay.
on.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and start hearing from some people that might have some more answers to why they do this. So if you have ever responded to spam, please let us know. If you've got questions and comments about technology more seriously, please give us a call now. The lines are open, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out those numbers again in just 1 second. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruzeiro Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruzeiro has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found online at cruzeiro.com or by calling 459-6301.
KUSP co-sponsors the 2007 Songwriter Showcase. Songwriters will showcase their musical creations and be judged on originality and content. There will be 8 prize winners, with prizes such as recording time at Mars Studios or gift certificates at Offshore Music. This event will be held every Tuesday
at 7 p.m. for 12 weeks starting March 13th at the Britannia Arms in Aptos. All songwriters must register by contacting Ken at 688-8435. That's 688-8435. And, of course, the public is invited to come hear the best of original music on the Central Coast.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks today are Sean Cleveland and Miles Elam. We are speaking with Danny Goodman, author of Dynamic HTML, the definitive reference. He's an expert on Dynamic HTML, and also of Spam Wars, and he's an expert on spam and fighting spam. So please give us a call if you'd like questions and comments for Danny, or anything. We'll take anything today. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Stay tuned after Geek Speak on KOSP, Castle Cottage, our weekly children's program. That's 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, Lyle Troxell. We are speaking with Danny Goodman, and the phone lines are open. Rick standing by. 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Sean, I'm sorry, I thought you wanted to say something.
Oh.
Yeah, you had a question? Yeah.
You looked at me like I needed to read something.
No, you don't need to read
anything.
Like
I don't have anything in my hand. You know, I think we should talk a little bit about some of those, like the Algerian... Nigerian.
Not that there aren't some in Algeria.
I've seen variations of that mm-hmm. from other countries, mm-hmm. but... understand a lot of people who are listening don't know what that is. Maybe you could get a little more detail about what people are getting in their inboxes.
Right. The typical message of this type is first of all, it comes from someone you don't know, and the English is usually tortured in a way. But there's some story about either a deposed dictator or someone. You know, some American or European died in some car crash in Senegal or someplace, and they couldn't find the heirs. And so there are these millions of dollars stashed away in some bank somewhere, or gold bars or whatever. And this guy has taken it upon himself to contact you as in a business partnership to help extract these funds and. In a variety of ways, they want you to say that you're a relative of the deceased, or you're going to invest these funds. And anyway, so the promise is that there are all these, tens of millions of dollars, and for your trouble, you'll get 10 or 20% of that.
So it kind of works off the greed of the target.
Well, greed is the number one vice of email readers around the world, the ones who get into the trouble the most. And so what happens with these things, though, is that if you are sucked into it, you will find out that you're asked to send and wire money of all kind of various amounts because there are some fees and taxes and bribes, and then the money was being shipped to another country and it got sent to the Far East, and you got to send more money to get the stuff and the customs. Anyway, you end up spending. In some cases, more than $1 million of your own money, and this has happened.
What?
And professional business people, a Swiss college professor got taken for about $600,000 a couple of years ago. There was a fellow in Florida about a year and a half ago, a retired gentleman who sold his house and everything else and even knew the chief of police locally who told him it was a scam and ignored him. Spent well over $300,000 ultimately.
Now these all start with that message I've got 1,000 times that says, some random person contacted me out of the blue.
Yeah, I'm Miriam Abacha.
How can you assume, like, if someone came up to the street with you and had a suit on and was like, hey, I need your help to get some money out of a country, you would ignore them completely out of hand. I mean, I don't understand why people think that because it comes through email, it's more
legitimate. But people don't refuse it out of hand. I mean, Central Park is full of people who have been taken for a ride by someone just saying, oh, hey, I lost something. Can you come?
Really?
Can you give me some money so I can go, do whatever?
And the payday is tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. You don't need many takers.
Yeah. So when you get an email, do you just like when I sent you an email saying, "Hey, you want to be on the show?" Did you the first thing go, "Oh, this guy's trying to get me"? I mean, do you have to do that with everything?
unfortunately, because of the volume of it, and I call them attacks, mm-hmm. that can come your way, you literally have to be suspicious of every email message that comes in. You just can't click willy nilly on every message that's in your inbox. You need to first of all, you can recognize some things right away. There'll be either something in the subject that's of relevant context, and the from address that you see in the in your listing. There'll be enough of a link that's not necessarily guaranteeing that it's really what it is,
mm-hmm.
but if it's part of an ongoing conversation you're having with someone, you'll recognize that as being legitimate. Or if you subscribe to some sort of newsletter or mailing, and you have the same subject every month or every week and so on.
Sure.
Those are things that you can
and depending on the mood of your life and what's going on with you, you can be more susceptible to this kind of thing. If you have a pet just pass away or something, and you're or anything of that nature where you're really emotionally impacted, your barriers might not be the same.
Well, and also the kind of work that you do, you don't know what people are sending, who is sending you stuff, legitimate
right.
mail, and what the subject might read. It might be, I was talking with this about to a doctor of mine several months ago, and he's at UCSF in San Francisco, and he has some colleague he doesn't remember or even know could send him a message about some patient, and the subject matter, the subject line could be anything.
Yeah.
However, there are safe things that you can do to make sure that to limit your exposure.
Well, what's one thing you can do?
The biggest thing you can do is if your email program, or if you use web email, they have these options, is to disable image downloading
for the email.
For the email message.
Yeah.
And the reason
we recommend that all the time.
The reason you want to do that is that it's an old technique, and I still see it in messages. I view the source code, that the requests for those images are coded with either a number or your actual email address and it confirms back to the sender that your email address is still active and live and actively read.
And the thing is with these HTML email messages, if I send you a message and it has an image reference in it, in the HTML, and the image is actually on my server, and the request includes something that identifies you, when you view that message, you've told me your email is valid.
That's right.
That's all you need to do is
If you, in Outlook Express or Outlook, if you have the preview pane open,
right. Sure.
Just even viewing it in the preview pane with the images enabled will make that request.
All right. We're going to go ahead and start taking some calls. You can call in if you'd like. There's still room on the lines, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We'd love calls about dynamic HTML or spam, but we'll take anything you'd like. And from Watsonville, Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. So even opening a spam message creates more of the problem? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, it can if the message is coded to retrieve an image.
So how do you check if it should be deleted or not?
Well, first of all, if you get a message, let's say you get a message and it is only an image that would be downloaded, mm-hmm. so the message will be blank, and you have to assume that it's not something you want.
So what you're saying, Danny, is if I sent you an image of my kids and the subject line was, "Hey, take a look at this," you'd never open it.
Especially if the from did not identify from you.
Uh-huh.
Now the from field can be forged.
Right.
On any email message, so you can't trust that as a complete signifier. But
okay, so Judith, did you have more of a question?
Yeah, I had a couple more questions. I mean, one of the things I've found the anti phishing working group.
Mm-hmm.
There's report phishing at phishing.org, at anti-phishing.org, and then there's the spam at uce.gov is the Federal Trade Commission site.
Right.
And I've been trying to forward spam messages to those.
You're trying to help
Is that helpful, or is that just by having to open it up and forward it, am I just perpetuating?
Well, first of all, how they want the message is not the way you're typically forwarding it. They want the entire what's called a source code or source view of that message, which includes
a lot of
gobbledygook that's called header that you don't normally see but is actually part of the message. Typically, when you forward a message from your email client, That stuff gets stripped out.
Well, I usually forward it from my desktop, my mail. I have Macintosh on the mail.
Yeah, that still would do it. It still strips out a lot of information.
Yeah.
All that's left is the subject line and such.
But most email programs will let you view the source of the source code of the email, entire email message.
What about redirecting?
Redirect. Oh.
You do a redirect instead of a
forward.
Yeah,
maybe that would work.
Well, except a redirect, you don't normally see.
Mail has that option.
Yeah. I think a redirect might work. You know, what I would suggest, Judith, is since you're using mail on a Macintosh, if you go to View and you go to, where is it?
I used Entourage. So
messages. It's under View and then Message. There's raw source. Mm-hmm. You can look at that, and that's the actual message itself.
Yeah, and viewing the source of an email message is completely safe.
Oh, okay.
In fact, if you can switch to raw source before you open it, you're being safer.
Oh, okay.
But you might not be able to find out if it's spam or not from that, depending on how well you can read code. Judith, was that all in your questions?
Well, I had one other. I've been particularly, this is wonderful that you're having this thing on spam. I have an email account that's just really spammy, and I'm having trouble getting any kind of filtering set up for it.
Yeah.
And I've been looking online. I found like a dspam.org place, and I didn't know whether you know of any free spam filters for like Macintosh, and it's for an online account that mm-hmm. just forwards my email. It's not a
what
pop.
Do,
I can't.
What do you think about that, Danny? Do you have any solutions for someone who has an email address that needs to be pretty public, and you want to get a level of safety there?
Yeah,
before the client even sees it.
If the best place for filtering is at the incoming email server, because it minimizes the ultimate download of the email to your client.
Yeah.
Can I ask who the hosting?
Well, the hosting it's a Stanford alumni.org account, and it's USANet. And I don't have the premium account, I guess, so I'm getting. They used to have filtering, but so if I need to pay money, and then it'll get better, or maybe if I pay money, it won't get better. I don't know.
Well,
I'd contact them and say, I'm really concerned about the amount of spam that's happening on this list, and can you help me out?
Yeah, and then I figured out how to sort of mark things as spam, but then you have to open things to block the sender or get figure out the email address in order to do it. And so that sounds like from what you're saying is just that that's just going to add to the problem instead of solving
it. Well, most of the most egregious spam, the email address of the sender that's listed there is completely bogus. So, and they change second after second.
Uh-huh.
So the fact that you would list that from sender as being a spam sender, that will not help at all.
That was going to be my intuition, too, that there's so it's so easy to forge that it's not the best way to do it.
The other suggestion, Judith, is to, if you can open up like a Gmail account or, any one of the...
A Yahoo account.
Yahoo, mm-hmm. Any of the free email services that have good filtering in them.
Uh-huh.
And let them do the filtering for you first.
So you forward the message
to them. Forward to that and then forward it from there to next place.
Or just check it from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Checking from there is always a good way to go.
And those services, they'll initially, they do have good filtering, but then you can train their filtering to do an even better job.
Uh-huh.
I'd recommend that, too. You get something that's dealing with a lot of email messages, and their systems are very good at detecting spam because they see so much email. Because you're kind of training in artificial intelligence.
I could forward it through my. I have an AOL account. If I forward it to there,
AOL has
system. Really good.
Yeah, Judith, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. This has been really helpful.
Great, call again. Bye bye. All right, so we've got some more calls coming in. I think we'll go ahead and go to Santa Cruz. Tom, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. What's your question today?
Yeah, I have a. A basic web design class that my students use GeoCities, and we use Composer with Netscape.
Uh-huh.
It's fairly simple, and we send our URL to Google, it should be straightforward. I mean, they have the meta tags for keywords and all of that, and yet their sites have not been searchable.
We do
a test. We put some magic words in their keywords so that they can test Google later on, and they're just not searchable. So do you need a robot text or something of that nature in your site in order to have
you,
the Google?
You don't need a robot text, no. But you're trying to get Google to what's called index your site,
right.
And you're using GeoCities. I would say that, what do you think is happening here, Miles? Why isn't Google showing up? Have you waited more than a week? Sometimes two weeks?
Oh, yeah. We've waited, it's now been about 2.5 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And it's an account on GeoCities, though?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, say again?
It's an account on GeoCities. Like
yeah,
the URL,
all,
the URL yeah, is not its own domain.
Right, right. Well, actually, that's not. One of the students went ahead and got their own domain name. And even hers is not working. And through GeoCities, she's got a domain name, so that's a paid subscription. But most of the students are just using the free.
Well,
GeoCities.
Now when you say you're searching for them, how are you searching for them? Are you searching for them in keywords in the meta tag keyword list?
Right.
Because those meta tag keywords will be ignored completely by Google. I mean, I would assume. Yeah, you know, in an HTML document, you can put in a whole bunch of keywords in what's called a meta tag. Well, those keywords, if they're not relevant to the data that's actually in the HTML document, Google's not going to want to use them as searchable, because what Google's trying to do, any search engine's trying to do, is find content a person searched on and give them that content. If the only place that that word shows up is in the meta tag, then Google's not going to think that that page has any relevance to that. Let's say I put up a page about selling prescription drugs, and then in the meta tag I put long life. If you search for long life, Google will not deserve that page, because in the page itself, it doesn't say anything about long life. So you've got to think about it from the perspective of what Google's trying to do. And
well,
mostly that's about fighting
meta
spam.
Tag, you know, the keywords do reflect on the sites. I mean, we're not just putting random words in there.
I would say try to search for a phrase inside the body of the actual HTML. You can do a four-word phrase inside there that looks relatively unique with quotes around it. And if that's not showing up, that means Google's not indexing your site. And that would come down to
you've done that as well.
Miles, do you have any idea on this?
Is there some magic code that we can put in that Google automatically index?
No.
I mean, the only thing that I know about, and it's by domain, is when you're searching on Google, like just putting in your keyword that you're searching for, and then the word site, S-I-T-E, colon, and then the domain name.
But they're not finding, I mean, Google's basically not indexing these pages. Why would Google not index pages? First off, there's no way to make Google do something. In fact, trying to game the system will cause you to be banned from Google's indexing. It's pretty strict about what they want to be able to index. But
and Google's, yeah, and Google's thing is Google's algorithm is mostly based on who is linking to you.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Make sure you link to each other, and also find another site, maybe the school that you have, link to a couple of the pages from there. It's very possible Google won't.
So Google will index sites that have other links or sites that have gotten a lot of hits before. If they link to you, then you've become more visible.
That's kind of it.
It's a popularity contest, basically. It's if you have some resource like you're selling car parts, and you are the authority on it, then a lot of people are going to link to you as the authority on car parts. So when you click on car parts, you show up because you have 30 people linking to you or more. If you don't have anyone linking to you, then you're just one page out of many, and you may not have the relevance that someone is looking for.
I see. So the number of links to your page. Okay, well, this makes sense, because I had in the earlier class,
it was
I had people list to the DMOZ, and that their website was kind of politically, you know, was one of those kind of lefty websites that, you know, the peace and justice kind of things, and because of the nature of the website, a lot of people linked back to that website.
That'll do it. That's what Google likes to see, sure.
And those websites come right up on the first page of Google.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for the call.
All right. Thank you. That helped.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, that's definitely the trick, is if you've got good content and people are linking to that content, Google will start indexing you more frequently as well.
Or will list you.
Something also from my own experience is that if you... you have to keep your pages fresh, keep putting new content, and the more frequently the spider finds that you've updated the page, the more live it thinks the site is.
And the more frequently it will check for updates.
Right.
That's right. All right, we're going to go ahead and take another call, this time about email. Eric from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Howdy.
Hi. What's your question today, Eric?
I'll start. One of my sort of pet peeves is getting mail from, for example, real banks or other financial places. And really the fact that what I found is that these aren't spam, but while they're somewhat, I would say, unsolicited, they will actually contain links. Let's say I got one a while ago. It was from Discover Card. And in it had links to some site that was like novusnetmail.com or some, you know, some other site that, I mean, it could have been Discover, but, you know, people can name a site anything. Now, guarantee, you know, they're telling me, oh, I should feel secure because I have HTTPS and it connects to the site. But how do I know that name actually relates truly to Discover?
Danny?
If you know enough to view the source code of the message, you can look at the source code and find out where the real link is taking you.
Well, no, it was going to this other name, NovusNetMail, which or whatever it was, and it was actually real because I went to Discover and called them and figured it all out.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
How do I know that happened to me once?
I got something that claimed to be a survey from the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, it came from someone other than WSJ.com, and so I got all hot and bothered thinking that someone was ripping them off. And it turned out that Wall Street Journal had, in fact, hired some third-party outfit to mail it. So, you know, other than you know, actually checking with the source that you trust to find out if it's real.
There's no way to do it, really.
Well, there is. I mean, the company that I until recently worked for has an archive of URLs or category database.
Is it accessible for free?
No, it isn't. Okay. That's the thing. It's not really made for individual users, though. It's a thing for organizations, and the URLs that show up in the emails, they will actually check against their database.
Should we with some degree be complaining to our ISP providers or people that are providing our emails saying, you know, you should be checking all these messages against some database? What do you think, Miles?
Personally, I think we should actually be leaning on the folks like Wall Street Journal and Discover to say, make these subdomains, make it so that it's easy for us to see that it's affiliated with you. Because
it doesn't take
much time to make a host entry.
And also a responsible mailer, and I would hope that Discover is that case, should have mail preferences that you can set with them, whether you get these things or not.
Yeah. I mean,
well, in this case, it was one of those, like, it was a mail reminding me about security, of all things.
Yeah.
Never mind. And the thing is also, I mean, the same thing happens when you go to many of these shopping sites. As soon as you click to do the secure transaction, you're at blah, 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 dot shopping, dot com,
right.
Some other site. How do I know they truly link?
You can't.
But keep in mind that if you're on a website and you're doing purchasing and you click and the URL changes to a secure URL and your shopping cart is still with you, you're pretty much assured that everything's okay. What's going on is if I'm a little store, like let's say like a little store selling paintings or something, and I want to sell them securely to you, to pay for an SSL certificate or the thing that makes HTTPS available, that little lock icon, that costs money. That costs $150 a year. And if I'm a little outfit, that's going to be a lot of money for me. So instead I'm going to go find a store that will host the security aspects of it, deal with the credit card transactions, everything, for a little fee. So now you go along, you build a shopping cart, and then the shopping cart's passed off to this other body that's going to deal with the more secure stuff. So you have to kind of trust that in the website path, it's viable because the site that you're doing the shopping at, the trusted location that you first started at, has the links embedded in their site. I haven't seen any scams in the case where that's not true, but I don't know how to test that necessarily without doing the purchase and see what happens.
Of course, the good thing is, about, you know, at least by credit card, except from the credit card number theft possibility, is that if it were a scam, then you're at least protected as a consumer. You could have that card compromised if in fact it goes to a bad site. I mean, I do online purchasing all the time, but I get to know the site first. The main site, the shopping site, and then I just cross my fingers and hope that they are linking to the right third party payment
system.
Processor.
Yeah, Eric, thank you so much for the call.
No problem. Take care.
We're going to go again to Santa Cruz. Hal, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Hal. What's your question today?
Hi.
Hi.
I called while you were answering the first caller's question. She was a Mac user, and I had asked the phone answerer just to convey the same question for PC users.
Oh, okay, great.
And specifically, I would ask in either Outlook or Thunderbird, if you if you allow your client to show a preview, what the effect is.
Okay.
And secondly, what you should do to forward the message to the entity that's being imitated, or you know that they're impostering, like eBay or PayPal or whatever.
Okay, great, Hal. Thank you very much. Well, should we just answer this off air?
Okay, I have to turn my radio back on.
Okay, thank you, Hal, for the call.
Thank you.
I'll reiterate. Basically, Hal's wondering, on a PC like Outlook or Thunderbird, how do you turn off what's called remote image loading or something like that? How do you do that? In Thunderbird, it's relatively easy under preferences, under security. There's a checkbox for loading remote images. I think that's what they're called. Anybody using Thunderbird right now can show me? In any case, that's about what you're going to look for. In Outlook, Danny, do you know if there's a way to do that?
I don't know if the newer ones do. I know the the typical like Outlook Express and so on that I've seen don't offer an image download block. They may now. I'm not sure.
Yes, Outlook does. Unfortunately, I don't know the past. Yeah. I know that it does because the system administrators on previous company's network, they actually globally did it for everyone's computer.
The big thing is
there is a setting for it.
Under securities in either of these email clients, any email client should be under security, and you want to disable JavaScript and you want to disable image loading. And then when you actually view the message and you feel like it's a valid message, there's normally a button you can click to say load the images, and you're kind of telling it to now force to load.
Yeah. Right. Personally, I can't think of a single reason why you'd want to have JavaScript running in an email client.
Listen, I'm Mr. JavaScript, but there's no reason JavaScript should be running an email.
Disable, definitely. Right. From Sunnyvale, David, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes. I was calling about how can you trust a website that's running HTTPS.
Well, as long as the domain name is a valid domain name, if you're running HTTPS, it's trustable.
Well, that means that there's a secure...
Isn't it going to check the internal certificate database to verify that the signer is actually...
Yeah.
So, I mean,
But even
if it's a VeriSign signed certificate, you're going to be able to check that, and your browser's going to automatically do that. You might see a warning. If you're seeing a warning, then you can't necessarily trust it.
That's right.
It's not a trusted certificate authority.
Right.
How many people know what a certificate authority is?
Yeah.
the thing is that if you're seeing warnings, you know, and we're talking about personal information, you know, maybe people should try and learn about it.
David, I got to go. Unfortunately, the show is almost over. Thank you so much for the call. I want to thank our guest today, Danny Goodman. His most recent book is the third edition of Dynamic HTML, The Definitive Reference. And he also has a book called Spam Wars, if you want to learn a lot more about how to fight spam and what's going on with the spam economy. Danny Goodman, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you. And also see the music video at SpamWars.com.
That's right, SpamWars.com. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks a lot, Mo.
GeekSpeak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBH, San Otto. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission to the geeks and to all of you for listening and calling. Thank you so much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Talk to you next week.